do the research, trying to find out like, you know, where your audience are and who they are, like try to describe their persona, their profiles, and locate them. Then we may have a clear target. Okay, those guys, those people here, okay, I should like target them. And the second, try to find a weapon. The weapon being like, you know, marketing. So how I can approach those guys, how I can market my brand to those people.
Welcome to the International Expansion Podcast. My name is Ramsey Pryor, and I spent the past 5 years taking one of Silicon Valley's fastest growing startups into new markets all around the world as head of international expansion and sales. Tech companies are able to expand overseas faster than ever before, but there's quite a lot that goes into getting it right. And each new market has its own unique and fascinating set of quirks and challenges. The best way to prepare is to learn from people who have been there before. So I started this podcast to gather the best practices from tech's most admired startups. We cover their successes and the things they got right, as well as their mistakes and learnings, all so that you can benefit from their hindsight as you take your company global. Thanks for listening. And if you or your company is looking for guidance on your expansion journey, or if you have feedback or suggestions for future episodes, please visit portofentrypartners.com and send us a note.
Welcome to another episode of the International Expansion Podcast. Today's discussion is focused specifically on entering the China market. China is one of the most complex and challenging markets for foreign companies to succeed in. It has so many hurdles to solve, including regulatory challenges, geopolitics, and a large language and cultural learning curve. But for those who succeed, the rewards and the market potential are massive. With a GDP of over 18 trillion, it's the second largest economy in the world. And in terms of population and potential end users, it is the largest. One of the very first things you have to do extremely well is to find the right person to lead your team there. And so I'm really happy to have Jason Lee as my guest today. Jason has been on the early teams of not one, not two, but three well-known foreign companies, including Gartner, LinkedIn, and most recently at Branch, which is where Jason and I got to team up. Jason scaled up our business from zero to becoming one of the highest performing regions, many quarters, and one of the best performing teams in the whole company, eventually having three China offices and landing many of the largest logos in China over 3 short years. Jason is also a multi-time startup founder and is currently the CEO and building a new SaaS startup backed by Branch called Branch CN. Jason, great to talk with you again and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Ramsey. Glad to be in this episode and really appreciate this opportunity to share some of my perspectives.
So Jason, you've been one of the first on the ground at many well-known tech companies that have entered China. And my first question is, I'm curious, given all the many choices that you have, why have you chosen to work for foreign companies within China so many times?
I think that's a really good question. The shortest answer is that I haven't really received any job invitations from any Chinese companies yet.
Well, I'm sure they'll be coming to you quite a lot now, but tell me more.
Yes, I would say I was trained like, you know, in the US company system, and especially, you know, when I started my SaaS journeys, software as a service. And then I started like talking to a few Chinese SaaS companies. I realized there's a gap between the Chinese and the US SaaS companies from like maturity perspective. I'll give an example. I think when I talked to a data analytics company years ago, and their co-founder who looked after their sales department shared with me that every day, every night, I think they're going to have like two sales meetings, like calling everybody from like, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, and Shenzhen at 10 p.m. and every night to give the sales updates. That to me just feel like they don't really understand the sales cycle for SaaS. Because normally we know, like, you know, selling a product in SaaS business is normally takes like, you know, 90 days. That's the selling cycle. And you shouldn't expect a sales update on daily basis. I think it's more like a selling cell phones to me, you know, their approach. So I would say one of the reasons that I didn't really consider Chinese SaaS company, I think there's quite a lot of them are not like very matured in China. That's one reason. The second reason is that we haven't seen any giant SaaS companies coming up in China. Although we know, like, you know, we have Alibaba, Baidu, you know, Tencent, Baidu, but they are more like, you know, individual consumer centric business, but not like, you know, B2B SaaS business. So I think that's the two reasons.
Interesting. You kind of knew early on you wanted to be focused on B2B perhaps, and you saw that the way of doing B2B, you just felt like it made more sense the way that you had seen and experienced with US companies. I've heard many people talk that I've met from China talk about the difference between working cultures in China and in the US. And I know the expectations can be quite demanding for employees in China. So we'll get into the specifics of those sorts of things. But before we get super deep into the details, now that you've been part of multiple well-known foreign companies going into China, I'd like to ask you first, have you seen any patterns or trends that you could see applying to all the entry experiences you've been part of in terms of challenges or the way things need to happen? Or has every experience been quite a bit different? Do you see any similarities between them, or have they all been unique?
I would say each business model is like unique, and the way they get into China is unique. However, to look back, I can see some successful examples for the US companies getting to China. They do have a pattern, or they do have, like, you know, a similar journey. So the first thing I think they do is like try to get into China very carefully, like a test of the water with selling some, like, you know, existing product, like the product they're already selling in the global market. They just, like, you know, translate it and bring to China to sell it. I think if you look LinkedIn, or like even you look like a branch selling to the export market, is pretty similar. They do have a product, just take them here to China to sell it and test the water. I think after a while, then most of those companies, if they can prove there is a little bit like, you know, product market fit, and they move to the second stage, trying to find an option to have a business partner, have a local business partner, and to look for some, you know, more creative ways for the entity structure. So I give an example like LinkedIn. I think when they get into China, probably after a few months, then they find like a Sequoia Capital and some other, you know, VCs to form up a joint venture to do the business. And GitLab in China is the same. They separated their business and work with the local management team to build up new VCs. So I think the second step is more like, you know, find a more creative joint venture, sort of like the entity structure, and to make the business operating properly in China. The third thing normally they do is like based on the existing product, the experience, and based on their new company structure, normally they will develop some like localized, very localized product or business model to meet like the local needs. Example like LinkedIn. So LinkedIn is pretty much like a web-based, you know, business back then when I was with them, like, you know, 2013, 14. And but in China, they developed a specific app, like a mobile centric called Chutu, just for China. And Canva, another example. Canva, I think in the global market, they focus pretty much on the B2C market. Like users use their templates to create sort of the post, something like that. But in China, their business model shifted a little bit. Like they focus quite a lot on the B2B part, providing, you know, enterprise solutions. And for our branch, it's the same. You know, we sell like a deep link and mobile attribution to the Chinese export advertisers when we first entered into China. But after like the first step, second step, and third step I mentioned, now we are building a new platform. It's pretty much like, you know, a gamification campaign platform just to, you know, sort of the customize the solutions for the Chinese developers only. So I think that's the pattern I see. Long story short, like test water as the first step, then find some like, you know, new entity structures. That's the second step. And third one is like having a brand new localized product. That's the last one.
Wow. That's a really interesting way to capture the differences. I hadn't really thought about what, you know, the way that you put it, but looking back, I definitely know that we did it that way at Branch. And I hadn't really realized that when multinational companies are going into markets, they often think about how much I'm going to have to localize what I do, if at all, to succeed. But it does seem like, and now that you've brought it up, that for China, most of the companies to succeed end up going in with a localized version, but then developing something that's really specific for the local market that is completely different than what's sold anywhere else. Thank you for capturing that. A lot of companies, when see, I guess, the market potential on paper, they see the size of the economy, they see the size of the user base that they could serve. They get very excited about the potential, the revenue potential of China. But there's a massive education that every company is going to have to go through before they even begin so that they understand what they're up against. And there's so many stories of companies that have gone and tried and failed. So maybe if you can talk a little bit about what are some of the big differences that you need to know that if you haven't done this at all before, what are the first things that I need to know about going into China that are different from any other market in Asia?
The first thing probably should realize that the whole internet ecosystem in China is different from the rest of the Asia or the rest of the world. For an example, like, you know, Facebook, Google are not working here, and we have the great China Wall. So basically, if you wanna, you know, log into your Google account in China, you have to go through the VPN, and which might like slow down your business efficiencies, stuff like that. If you're doing like a SaaS business, and you should also use the VPN. You know, that's pretty much a trouble. I think you both and of us like know this experience. That's the first thing. The whole ecosystem is different. The second thing is that mobile is pretty much like, you know, advantages here in China. Everything is on mobile. Everything is based on QR code. We recently had this experience of trying to help a app developer to promote their business in Europe. But when we talk about, hey, do people use QR code there? The answer seems like no. But in China, it seems like everything is on QR code. That's the second thing. So basically, like, mobile is pretty much like, you know, everywhere. The third thing is that I think most importantly is that China is a highly competitive market compared with any other market in Asia. So if you are about to enter China, I think the first question you should ask yourself is like, why isn't the product in China yet? Why isn't someone built it yet? Or is that someone built a similar product, but not exactly the same? I give an example, like still regarding Branch, like years ago, when we do the research about the China market, like, you know, attribution, like deep link, then we realize, wow, actually, they already have like two unicorns doing a similar business in China. So I think to answer a question, like, comparing with like the other markets in Asia, China is really, really competitive. So be well prepared for those questions before we get into China.
Yeah, if you don't see the service that you've invented over there, don't assume it's because they haven't thought of it. There could be a reason, or there could be companies that you just haven't been able to Google yet because Google doesn't cover, you know, as well, or you can't find them. But yeah, you know, there might be a massive company already doing, or many doing exactly what you would like to do.
Yeah, absolutely. In China, we have a word to describe it. So in Chinese, it's called the Juan, Nei Juan. So in English, it means like, you know, everything is just like so competitive. And I give an example, like, you know, even within like a large companies like a Tencent or Binance, once they identify a good idea, they normally gonna immediately just build up like, you know, 3, 4, 5 teams, separate teams, give them some resources, traffic resources, like, you know, funding resources and, you know, engineering resources. Like you guys just build it, and in the end, who's gonna stand out, then who's gonna win. So they create sort of the internal competition for some ideas first. So you think about it, if as a foreign company, you wanna get into China and be prepared for that. So competition is everywhere.
I remember, Jason, you told me once about how hard it is for startups inside of China, because there are the massive companies that if you start coming up with something that looks pretty promising, like you said, they will put people on it and demolish the competition. And so I think that, I don't know if you gave me this analogy or someone else, but it's sort of like you have to grow as a plant in a field with elephants that will easily stomp you very quickly in your lifespan. So you have to grow, you know, quietly and carefully until you're big enough to actually compete. And I know that, you know, we focused on those Chinese companies selling to Chinese companies that rather than competing in the domestic market, chose to focus on selling into international markets. And we even created that as a segment and focused on just those companies. Can you talk a little bit about how, if you want to get started selling into China or testing it, as you say, what are some of the segments that you could practice on or try before you really commit to see if this is going to work out?
So first thing, I think before I really get into this market and figure out whether there's a market need. And that go back to, you know, the previous discussion about like, you know, hey, if you think there's a product need, why there isn't a supply yet? I think that is the question we have to properly research. And second one is like, you know, trying to figure out the regulation restrictions. For example, like, you know, before we compete with these giant companies, do we have the proper like ICP license? Because it may take like a few months, and even if you don't really have it, and probably the competitor could just easily sue you and put you into the court, and your business is gone, right? And do you meet the local, like, you know, privacy and data security regulations? And that could also, you know, be the bullets from your competitors. I think after this done, the research done, next thing is like, you know, the simplest approach is just try to sell into the prospects, even without any team or without any product in place. So this is normally what I do. I build a pitch deck and then talk to my customer. Hey, you know what? This is a product, awesome product, and which been proven in the international market. And do you see the value here? If you see the value, are you willing to pay it here? If you are willing to pay, how much are you willing to pay? Can you put like a $500 on the table now to make like a reservation? And if the answer is like, yes, it's interesting, but let me think about it, which means probably it's not a real need. Or maybe they, oh, I'm willing to pay, but like, you know, I just willing to pay like probably $1, not like a $500. And I think that also tells something. So I think my approach here to easily test it out is just to bring the product, the demo, anything, the pitch deck, to your prospects and ask them to pay immediately.
I love that you guys always pitched with whiteboards rather than sales presentations as well. I thought that was a very interesting insight. Let me go back and touch on two things that you kind of referenced in case people are not aware. The first one is the whole notion of ICP licensing, the fact that you can't just, you know, put up a website and start selling in China. It's not that simple. Can you talk a little bit about if you're a foreign company and you want to have to do e-commerce or sell something over the web? Can you talk about what's required to do that legally?
Okay, I think I'm not an expert for that, but I can share some limited information that I collected. I think as for ICP, we have two types of ICP license. I think one is called ICP certificate. Another one is like ICP license. As for the certificate, it's like, you know, pretty simple and easy. As long as you have a website and you should and you could apply a certificate within maybe like in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and it doesn't cost you much. So I think that's pretty standard thing, no matter like you Chinese company or foreign companies. But second thing, ICP license is that if you are a content provider, let's say on your website, you're going to host a lot of the contents, and I would say that's going to be something different. And you may need like, you know, an ICP license, and it will take like normally like a few months up to like 6 months. And what's more, if you want to go further, like in the future, get to IPO stage, I think a lot of companies will have a VIE structure in China. Then it may also require ICP license as well. So I think like, you know, this is pretty much like, you know, hurdle for quite a lot of the U.S. companies or foreign companies, especially the internet companies, getting to China. And that is something I highly encourage, that people just get a outside consul or local consul to do a consultation.
Thanks for that. And I did actually have to get pretty deep into the weeds of what's required for those two different types of ICP licensing, the ICP filing, and I know I'll mispronounce it, or the Bei'an.
Yes, that's what we call it, like certificate.
Yeah, and then, you know, I know that if you actually want to retake money and locally or sign contracts, you need the more robust one, which requires approval, and they want to know what segment you'll be selling to, and it's certain entire industry segments like education are incredibly tightly restricted or even off limits to foreign companies. So you definitely have to do your homework, you know, regulatory wise, to even know whether you're allowed to compete domestically. And if so, what types of licenses you'll have to get. Jason, coming back to the other thing I wanted to ask, you said that when you were considering which career and which companies you wanted to work for, that you had not seen many Chinese B2B businesses or software businesses. Is that still the case? And if so, does that mean there's an opportunity for foreign B2B software companies? How do you interpret that?
I think definitely that should be the opportunities for the foreign companies, foreign software companies getting to China. But the second thing, it also reflects some of the market situation. First one is that people normally say Chinese companies are not willing to pay for software, or they are willing to pay very little to a software. And the second thing is that in China today, we see more and more companies putting a lot of the conscious on the data security part, which means SaaS, software as a service, might not be the best solution for a lot of the companies. They sort of like a prefer on-premise solutions. This is a little bit like a sort of like against, you know, the trend, but it's what it is today. We saw some of the companies being very successful because they offer such like on-premise solutions. And the third thing I would say, Chinese companies tend to build stuff by themselves rather than buy something from somewhere else. Give an example, CRM. We all see that, you know, Salesforce is like, you know, probably $200 billion company or $100 billion company. It's pretty big. And if you look at a CRM system in China, it's going to be huge as well. However, we haven't seen anybody standing out, like, you know, doing really good in the CRM market in China, no matter like you foreign companies or you domestic companies. I think one of the reasons is that they just like trying to build everything by themselves if they grow big. Take like attribution as an example. In China, like, you know, the large internet giants, like, you know, Meituan, like, you know, Baidu's, I think when they do the attribution, they just try to build a self-attribution network system by themselves rather than talk to some of the service providers. I think that also makes the hurdle for the foreign companies or domestic companies to grow up in China. So I would say, to answer your question shortly, yes, there is an opportunity. However, there are more challenges we have to face.
That's fascinating. In so many ways, that reminds me of software sales in the US before cloud became popular, when everyone was doing things on premises, when companies' IT departments were developing all sorts of applications for the company itself. Now it feels much more like everything's Legos. It's all SaaS-based services you plug together. I think I recently read that on average, companies in the US use something like 180 SaaS solutions to make up their full stack. Do you feel like, if you had to make a prediction, do you think Chinese companies will eventually start consuming cloud-based services instead of building it themselves? And does that open up opportunity for foreign companies who do SaaS? Or do you think that it's going to stay the way things are for a while longer?
If you ask my personal thoughts, I would say I'm 100% believer that, you know, all the Chinese companies will open to cloud-based SaaS subscription softwares, because that's like, you know, more efficient. And the second thing is like, you can't build anything by yourself, and that's not your core business. Why should you build that? I think that's my philosophy. But in the short term, I would say it really depends on the vertical of what softwares are you building and what industry and what functions that basically what value you can provide to your customers. So I would say, like, you know, in the end of the day, it's still about, like, you know, the value you offer to the customers. If the value is strong enough, and I don't think they're going to just build it by themselves. And if the cost is too much, I think they wouldn't consider building by themselves. I think it's eventually still about the value.
Jason, I'd love to get into details specific to sales. You did a fantastic job going from zero to taking your team to being one of the highest performing at the company for many quarters. And that's no easy feat given all the challenges we just talked about. And you kind of referenced the, you know, something about Chinese companies. There's a perception perhaps that it's harder to get them to pay for software, especially if they feel like maybe they could build it themselves. You managed to do it. So let me ask, what's different about selling in China? How did you pull it off? And what advice would you give a company that wants to do is a fantastic job of selling to Chinese companies?
Right. I think I don't have any secret here, but I'm a strong believer, again, of value selling. I would say no matter we are selling to a US company or selling to a Korean company or a Chinese company, in the end of the day, it's still about, like, you know, how can you present your value to the customer and to solve their problem. So I would say, like, you know, right now, even like in my current SaaS startup, I always emphasize, like, you know, value setting approach. So basically, the framework is pretty straightforward. It's like you got to try to understand the corporate objective of your customer. And then that's like, you know, what the CEOs, what the, like, board of directors, they care about. The second thing is, like, you know, you're going to figure out what is the business objective of the person that you talk to, which means, like, you know, a CMO, then probably lease acquisition, stuff like that, like, you know, one level down. And third one is, like, what are the pain points or, like, you know, the challenges stand in the way to stop him or her to achieve his or her business objective. Then what is, like, the solution in his or her mind? Just ask him to tell you what is the solution he expects. Then try to fit in, like, your solution. And try to figure out, like, the power, authority, buying process, timeline, stuff like that. So I would say I use this framework and coach it with the team, get everybody, try to become like a value seller. And then so no matter they talk to a traditional Chinese companies or maybe like a internet or like tech savvy companies, we all use this approach. But just like you got to tweak it a little bit, you know, based on the situation and the context. But in the end, I think value selling is the core that, you know, helped us to achieve quarter by quarter, like, you know.
It's comforting to know that it's not something totally different. It's at the end of the day, value selling works there too. I definitely noticed a lot of differences, maybe in sort of just the logistics, the details. You know, for example, it was impossible to use Salesforce to track sales activity in China for a number of reasons. And I noticed you guys were working at all hours of the day. And you told me a lot about the importance of showing your face, the importance of consistency, the importance of building relationships. So can you talk a little bit about some of those things that you think are actually different when selling in China, or more intense in some ways, or more relatively more important for the China market than you've seen elsewhere?
Well, a couple of things I think might be different. So first one is, like, you know, the relationship. I think Ramsey, you probably know the Chinese word, like guanxi. But I would say that's sort of like, you know, old-fashioned term. In the new business norm, I would say, like, you know, guanxi is important, but not that important in China. So compared with the other market. So second thing, the difference is that the Chinese customers normally would require a lot from you. A lot being two things. One is like extra effort. You are selling a software to them, but they may expect, hey, just give me some like a free consultation. Help me to do more work. That's like one thing. Normally we have to do that because, like, that's the way we build up trust since we're new to the market. Second thing is that they would require a very crystal clear results, like ROI results after using your product. I think that's like, you know, slightly different from the other markets we talk to, because like the value selling part is all about like, you know, ask the right questions and try to listen carefully and try to pitch your product and make the product and pinpoint like, you know, a value match, right? That's all about like a talking communication. But Chinese companies prefer to do the POCs, and they want to see the solid result after the POC. And whether you guys can deliver something fantastic, as you said, I think that might be different from the other market. So eventually, it's still about the product. If you have a solid product, if you can manage the POC well, if you can prove that you have a good result and a good ROI, I think even the Guanxi or the other stuff wouldn't be that important.
And Guanxi, just for folks who may not have heard that term or might have seen it but not know how it was actually said, that's that notion of the reciprocity, relationship-driven, you scratch my back, I scratch your back type of thing. I think there was maybe a stereotype that in certain markets in Asia, and China being one of them, you know, relationships really mattered. If you could build a relationship, that would open doors. Without it, you wouldn't get very far. Fair to say?
I think that's the way it used to be. But now, I'm not saying, right, Guanxi is not that important. But what I'm trying to say is that Guanxi is just like one of the factors that to win a business. And especially you are new to the market and you need some like introductions. Of course, you need to build up like some network and know somebody. Otherwise, like they wouldn't even give you a chance to do the POC. I think because like doing POC, they're going to put like manpower into it as well. So that's based on the trust, and the trust is coming from like a relationship from Guanxi. So I think from that perspective, yes, Guanxi is pretty important. And the second thing is like, if you are selling something very non-unique, okay, then Guanxi become the top priority, because I have this solution, you have this solution. In the end of the day, you know, it's probably Guanxi or relationship matters. But if you're selling something like unique, and I wouldn't say like a relationship dominates the whole business process.
This episode is brought to you by Globalization Partners. Many people assume that in order to enter a new country, you have to set up a new entity for your company, which can mean engaging in months of filings, years of investment obligations, legal fees, and a boatload of aspirin for all those headaches. That's a really heavy burden, especially if you're only hiring a few employees or if you're still testing a particular market. Globalization Partners invented a better way of hiring talent in other countries in 2012 that allows you to focus on hiring the talent you need and growing your company while they take care of the employment details. They provide locally compliant employee contracts, manage payroll, pensions, benefits, and a lot more as part of the package. And they cover 187 countries and 180 currencies. They offer all of this through their proprietary technology platform and provide experts you can call on when tricky situations come up anywhere in the world. And take it from me, these situations do come up frequently, and when they do, you want the most experienced people and the best technology behind you. For more information, visit globalizationpartners.com and choose the country you'd like to learn more about.
Let's talk about two other aspects. Building a brand, you know, you're starting from scratch. People probably have not ever heard of you, your company, what you do. How do you do that? You've done that now two or three times, building someone else's brand in China. And then how do you build the team to do all these amazing things? So let's start with maybe the first one. How do you build buzz for your company from scratch in such a giant market?
I think to build up a brand in China from scratch, the first thing is also to do the research, trying to find out like, you know, where your audience are and who they are, like try to describe their persona, their profiles, and locate them. And then we may have a clear target. Okay, those guys, those people here, okay, I should like target them. And the second, try to find a weapon. The weapon being like, you know, marketing, right? So how I can approach those guys, how I can market my brand to those people. So what we did is that back to the experience like in branch and LinkedIn the same. we normally find some third-party media agencies who specialize in this field, this vertical, and pay them a little bit money, and then they're going to host some sort of like hundreds of people event, like a growth salon for us. And we give them the names, sorry, the titles and functions and company natures. So they invited people here, then we just like, you know, market them what we want to see. So I think like that's the second thing, just find a partner who has those like connections, could help you to, you know, do the aspirate. And then the third thing is that try to win some iconic logos, build up some like, you know, case studies. And then with those people you have and with a case study, use that one like as a advanced weapon to, you know, educate them to get more trust. I think that's normally how we build up a brand in China.
What about finding your team in China? You know, we were really lucky to find you, and I think the folks that you introduced us to and some of the other folks that we met, I feel very fortunate that we got so lucky. It's very hard going into a new market to know where to look, what to look for, you know, especially when there's language differences, cultural difference. It's hard to know how to find the people, the type of people you think will be a good fit in a totally different place. So when you're building up a team in China, what do you look for? What do you filter out? And what catches your attention?
That might be like the most difficult part in building up a firm company in China, like, you know, build up the team. We do have some channels that in China could help companies to find candidates, like some, you know, local job boards, for example, like a boss, zhipin.com. That's like a very popular job site for tech candidates. Or you may use like a LinkedIn in China, but LinkedIn is not that popular. I think you could only attract like, you know, foreign candidates or maybe candidates in China, but with like, you know, international experiences or background. But I would say like, you know, so the first one, like, you know, the channels, how to find the candidates, except using those job boards, maybe use a good and trustworthy headhunter should be, I think, a very effective way, because those people could be the bridge between you and also the job market, the candidates, and they understand like, you know, what you are looking for, and they try to locate the right candidates for you. And save your time, cost a little bit much, but save a lot of your time. I think that's like, you know, how to find the candidates. But the second thing is like, you know, how to identify those candidates, or what is my criteria? I think I may have slightly different criteria compared with the other managers when you hire. I think to me, I classified candidates into like, you know, different layers, different tiers. So the tier S is like probably tier S, tier A, tier B, tier C. Okay. Tier S basically is someone like who is super driven, and he or she will tell you what to do as employee. And I think they are the leader, and they have a quality to attract similar quality people to join their team. I think they are the potential leader, the super level. And a tier A means like, you know, someone who you don't really tell him what to do, but he will get the job done properly. And you don't need to tell them like, you know, when's the deadline, but they're going to get things accomplished, you know, within the plan. I think they are A-class candidates. And B-class is that they have a pretty polished background from large companies, from maybe, you know, top-notch schools, but they also get their pay rise, you know, over different companies, different positions. But they're pretty good at like a PPT, doing the presentation. But you ask them to solve a solid problem, a very challenging problem, might not be the right person. So I call them like a B candidates. And there are a lot of the B candidates, pretty expensive. And each time asking for a very high salary. I think those candidates are a lot in the market. And a C candidates is like, you know, you ask them to do three things, then they get one thing done for you. So we definitely try to avoid it. So I would say, like, you know, when I try to build up my team in the past, I definitely try to look for like A or S candies, because once you have A or S tier candies, and they're going to get the business done, they're going to build a business for you. And a lot of things, you are not aware of that, and they will think about it. They will cover it for you. So I think, like, you know, that's my philosophy. And if we really look into this, like, you know, as ABC, I think three elements there. First one is like the skills. And the second one is like the knowledge. And the third one is like some sort of the soft qualities, like whether you're being driven or whether you're being like, you know, whether you have the ownership, whether you are problem solver, stuff like that. So I think, like, you know, from S or A candidates, those soft qualities are much, much more important than the skills or knowledge. So that's my philosophy. So if you look back, like, you know, when we're at Branch, we try to hire people. Some of the SDRs back then we hired, they didn't have any selling experience. They didn't have any experience working in a software as a service company. However, now they become the top sales. So I would say back then, I thought they should be the A or S class candidates. And their quality, self-driven, problem-solving, ownership, customer-first, those kind of like the soft quality weight much more than their skills or back or experience.
I like that rubric that you went through. And I can't stress how important it is, especially when you're building the first team on the ground, how important it is to find those self-starting, self-motivated people that are going to solve problems you didn't even realize you had because you're not there or you don't understand, you know, the market or the environment, but they do. So having people who are actually going to think outside their jobs is so critical. Beyond, you know, going direct and selling into your customers and building a great team, there's usually other players that you have to be aware of in any market. And I'd love to get your thoughts on who are the important people that you might not think of, whether they're agencies or influencers or partners or maybe even government entities that you need to consider when you're looking at the holistic picture of how to enter China. You know, how important are partners? A lot of people think when they think of going into certain markets they don't understand very well or certain parts of Asia, they think, oh, well, let's find a reseller. Let's find a partner that does know it. And of course, forever, even companies like Microsoft, they entered China through these big joint ventures and massive partnerships. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, what's the role of partners if you're going to go into the Chinese market? How would you vet a potential partner or find a good one or a trustworthy one? And is there anybody besides partners, you know, again, whether it's like an agency or an influencer or a government, you know, that you need to be thinking about too?
Okay. I think as for partner or channels, normally I would like, you know, segment it into different parts. So first one is like a marketing partner. Marketing partner, as just now you asked, like how to build up a brand. And we may need to get some like a PR partner or marketing partner who could help us to like, you know, just voice out our logos. Obviously, that's like one thing. And after we have the marketing awareness, second one is like, you know, find the channels, the channel partners. Channel partners, I would recommend like, you know, don't do it at the first place. So first, at the first place, probably we should like, you know, learn how to sell by ourselves and try to build up a direct selling team. And try to figure out whether there's a product market fit and what is the challenges here and how much a customer would need to pay. I think we need to have the first-hand data by setting the products by ourselves. And after we have some like experiences here, we should think about like have a channel partner. Channel partner could be like a reseller or could be someone just like a referral, the leads. I think it really depends on your business model. Right, that's the channel partner. And the third one, I think maybe we need to consider is that to lower down the cost or speed up like the process, probably we should consider some like integration partners, like, you know, Salesforce and some, a lot of the companies, they do have the, you know, integration partner here who could help them to deal with a lot of the very tedious, like this customization work from engineering perspective. I think that's quite important too. It could help you to speed up the whole selling process. And we continue the journey, I think move on. We may have some like, you know, our finance partners being like billing partners. Because I'm not sure whether you recall experiments like, you know, in the past, a lot of the Chinese companies, you know, they sign a contract but not willing to pay. And then, you know, the order form will become like, you know, a bad debt. So based on that, you may have some like, you know, local bidding partners to work with you and to chase, you know, the money and stuff like that. I think those are some sort of the very necessary partners we should consider. But at different stages, we may try to think about different strategies. And as for that, this influencers, I would say it's pretty popular in China, but I would say it's more regarding to the B2C business. And a lot of people get on like, you know, this live streaming to sell their products. We seldom see like, you know, B2B business would use key influencers a lot. So I think that might be a different scenario.
A lot of people go to China and don't do so well. You were part of companies that did quite well, but even then there are pitfalls, and there have been, you know, companies that did quite well and then they ended up retreating or getting shut down. What are the biggest mistakes, preventable mistakes that you have seen companies make when going into China?
I think there are a lot of the things when I learned from the past experience from, you know, the other companies who failed in China. The first one, I would say, is always about, like, you know, the product market fit, PMF. As I mentioned, you got a gorgeous product in the international market. Doesn't really mean that you can sell it well in China. Doesn't really mean that there is a market need in China. So I think that is something we should consider. And it's not just about like this this product itself. It's a combination of product, value, and also like, you know, your integration process and price, you know, a lot of the factors. So when I see the PMF, we should consider an all-round, you know, concept. For example, yes, there is a market need for this product. However, you are selling way more expensive than the local providers. Of course, you kind of win the market, right? For example, like, hey, you're going to have a very long integration process. I'm going to send your engineers from the US, do it. Of course, you can't compete with the local providers. I think that's what I call the PMF. That's a whole thing. It's not just a product thing. Okay. Probably I should call it a solution fit market. It's not, it's SFM, not PFM. Okay. So the second thing I would say is like, I see a lot of experience, the failures coming from the local team, like a local management team, authorization. So like a finance, like legal, a lot of times I see those teams in China report back to the HQ. And HQ gonna make the decision about like, hey, the bidding terms and the legal terms, stuff like that. However, I would say they have very little knowledge about what is going on in China, in this market. And if we talk about something like, you know, analogy is like you are fighting the battle in the field and you hear the gong, you hear the bomb, but you can't make a decision. Decision is making from some commander like, you know, miles away. They don't really know what's going on in this battle, in this field. So I think that's probably the second problem, who can make the decisions. The third thing, obviously, is like the leader himself, the local leader. We see quite a lot of foreign companies, they send someone from the headquarters, like employee, they thought they should have some sort of the Chinese background or experience, then send him from the headquarters to China to lead up the business as the CEO or as the general manager. However, the person may look like Chinese, but he doesn't really have any, like, you know, local experience. Although he can speak the language, but it doesn't really mean he knows the culture. So I think that causes a lot of the failure as well. So the local leader, that's being like number three. The last one, I would say, is stay in out. Basically, you're going to respect the local business norm and respect the market, respect your competitor, respect your customer. I think it works for every market, not only China. So again, before you get into the market, don't just think you can replicate your success or the way you do the business in another market, you can replicate success in China. Think about like, it's a brand new startup and try to figure out everything from the scratch.
So we talked about the mistakes that people often make. What are some of the best practices, pro moves, best things you've ever seen that you've put into your playbook in terms of, you know, going into China and doing it really, really well?
I can't really say that I have the, you know, experience to share to share to the audience that something we're doing really well. But I can basically think of something might be helpful. So the first one is like try to work with the headquarters and let them to give the authority to the local teams. That's pretty important from efficiency perspective. One example here, like in the past, marketing didn't report to me, and marketing reports to someone like in the headquarters. And if this marketing manager wants to run an event, for example, in another city, and she will ask for budget, then she will talk to the HQ marketing head. Then the HQ marketing head will talk to me and say, "Hey, Jason, do you think it's a good idea to spend money in another city for the marketing event?" Then I say, "Yes, I will explain why." I will explain it to the head of marketing in the HQ. Then the head of HQ will give the feedback to the field marketing manager in China. So basically, it's like a triangle. And it's spent a lot of time. I think like the first thing is like remove these hurdles. Try to get things like, straightforward. Right. That's like a first thing. Second thing is like try to, I think, escalate or let HQ understand the real situation in the local market. In other words, it's like try to communicate more and be more transparent. I think that's very important. A lot of times people may think the business world should be like this. However, on the other side of the planet, okay, it's daytime here, it's nighttime there. So I think you should let them know, oh, sorry, it's not daytime. You can't work, it's nighttime. People get to sleep. Okay, I think that's like, a second thing. We should be aware of that. Third one is that try to talk about like this, the business objections and your needs. I mean, with the global HQ transparently, because a lot of times the local leaders here in China, they are a little bit shy when they face the challenges. When they see objection here, they say, "Oh, fine, okay, I don't like let them worry about it. I'm gonna, just get it done by myself." However, I think the best team here is like, you get your manager, get your cross-function partners to be aware of, your situation, and they are willing to help. And just don't get anything on your shoulder. I think share the pain, share the experience, share the success stories. I think that's pretty important.
Thanks for sharing those. There's definitely some themes coming through loud and clear about the importance of really good communication between whoever's leading your team in China and headquarters, and trying to paint as realistic a picture as you can instead of trying to make it look like everything's easy and going great at all times. I think that's probably a very difficult thing to do in practice, to kind of show vulnerability or to give, things that don't sound like good news. I can see the fear of, why it would be scary to do that sort of thing. But I couldn't agree more that giving as accurate and a realistic and frank picture of things on the ground, without that, like you said, the commander from far away is not going to do a good job, without that view. And I think the more power you can decentralize and put into the hands of the folks on the ground, the better. So thanks for all those observations, Jason. One last kind of broad question. So the last couple of years between US and China have been bumpy geopolitically. And of course, COVID made things much, much more challenging for the entire world, but nowhere more challenging to do business than, it was doing business in mainland China during COVID, with all of the lockdowns and the quarantining that you had to do every time you crossed a border. And, I think foreigners were pretty much completely restricted So very difficult times to be doing business between US and China. Now, they just announced, I believe, at Davos that China is now open again for business. So would like to get your perspective. Is now a good time to dust off the plans for going into China and to restarting your dream if you're a company who's thinking about entering there? What's your perspective, you know, from the perspective of someone who does this now three times, four times, but also someone who's living there and has seen, you know, all of the last few years unfold? What's your perspective on that?
I would say the past few years was quite like a challenging for everybody, no matter like in China or out of China, given the pandemic impact, especially for us like who live in China, as you mentioned, business sort of like, you know, got like, you know, more and more difficult because like, you know, the restrictions here. I would say now it should be a good time for the foreign companies to consider re-entering to China. A couple of things. Number one, China lifted up this quarantine policy for business travelers. And that's really good news, even like for myself, who has been quarantined like for 8 times in the past 3 years. The second thing is that we can clearly see that the Chinese government has already put the focus back on the economic growth. Although like they've been doing this in the past, but now I think they just like trying to emphasize more on the economic growth and they try to be more open, try to be more like, you know, friendly to the foreign investors and to the private company owners. I think that's a really good thing. And I think in China, we have a saying that if you are in the wind, like, you know, even you are at peak, you can fly. Okay. So which means now we see the Chinese government try to open up everything and they try to stimulate the economy. And as a foreign investor, that's a really good opportunity to get into China. And that's the second thing. The third thing is that over the past few years, some like local companies or smaller companies, even like large companies, they laid off quite a lot of people. And those people, pretty good talents. And now I would say it's a good opportunity to grab the talents as well and at a reasonable cost to attract the talents, right? So I think like from talent perspective, the economy perspective, the policy perspective, and from like, you know, traveling, like a restrictions perspective, it all shows like a good sign that the economy should like bounce back very soon. That's like my personal experience. So I would use like one probably short phrase to conclude that. Just keep in confidence.
Jason, thanks for sharing all the perspective on the market, on your personal experience entering China and being the leader for multiple foreign companies who have done quite well there. I always learn so much every time I talk to you about this. You were one of the people that educated me the most on China. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for sharing all your thoughts with us today.
Thank you very much, Ramsey, for having me here. And it's a good opportunity to share some of my thoughts, you know, to your friends, to the audience. And glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to the International Expansion Podcast. If you found this information helpful, I hope you'll subscribe and share this info with a friend or colleague. As a reminder, if you or your company is looking for guidance on your international expansion journey, from sizing and prioritizing markets to getting up to speed on local conditions, finding world-class talent, or building up your brand and revenue, please visit portofentrypartners.com and send us a note. Until next time, take care.